podcast is part of the Sports Social Podcast Network.
Jones! Bowden! He's got it! England have won the World Cup by the barest of margins!
Stokes flashes it away through the covers for four, and England have won the match!
June 14th, 2022, the evening of, and we're all still catching our breath. I'm just thinking, wow, what have I just witnessed? What have 17,000 people in Trent Bridge, all of whom got entry for free, just witnessed? What have potentially millions of people watching on telly or listening on the radio have witnessed? An extraordinary run chase by England. And isn't it funny, Simon, that Trent Bridge seems to bring the best out of English batsmanship, doesn't it? Twice they've broken the world record in the ODI format at Trent Bridge. And now this, 299 to win in, what, 75 overs? And they, well, I mean, I'm sorry, they pissed it, didn't they? They absolutely waltzed it. And it was the most thrilling thing to watch. It must have been wonderful to be at.
It was a remarkable day. It was an I was there day, I think. You're right. Trent Bridge does lend itself to that sort of batsmanship, really, because, I mean, the pitch is good. It's got a bit of pace in it, bit of bounce, and the outfield lightning fast, you know, like a ice rink, whatever, glass table, billiard table, whatever you want to say. It was just impossible to hold England today once two players got in. It was a remarkable day. I mean, you said actually an interesting thing you said there, Yoz. You said 17,000 people. There actually were quite a few empty seats today. So I don't know where the missing people were. It's possible that people, you know, went for tickets and couldn't get the day off work or whatever, or thought they'd come down later after work. Well, if you're going to come down after work and you had a 5 o'clock finish, bad luck, because the game was done by 5:25. And if you said that at tea, that the game would be over in an hour and 25 minutes, you probably would have thought, well, that's because England had had another dramatic batting collapse, but none of it. I mean, that period of play after tea was just incredible hitting. Just you know, remarkable day. And here's to England's positivity if it's going to continue like that. I mean, yeah, there are going to be games where you can't play like that, surely. I mean, you can't, probably can't play that on slow, low wickets in Pakistan. But today it was just great fun. And, you know, it's been five magnificent days. Forget the future, forget the past or whatever. You could just enjoy what we saw over the last 5 days.
You mentioned 5 days there. And before the test, I did this podcast at the barest of margins with the England dietitian and the trainer. And they talked about making sure that the players got through the 5 days with the right sort of food and the right sort of sleep and the right sort of relaxation, and obviously topping up their nutrition all the time. What did they give Bairstow for tea? That's what I want to know, because whatever it was, I want some of it. It was just a transformation. A guy who, you know, really hasn't set the world alight so far since coming back from the IPL. In fact, he looked as if he was still playing in the IPL in some slightly tricky situations. Well, perhaps thank God he did. He does think he's still playing in the IPL today, because it was pure thunder, thunderous. I'll tell you what the word was, really: brutal. It was brutality. And that's the word that my old scorer associate, Harry Sharp, he was the scorer of Middlesex for many years, a bit of a blocker as a player, but a great character as the scorer. And there was a couple of times in my career when Mike Gatting just took whoever it was to the cleaners with a similar sort of innings, not quite the same distant hitting, but the same sort of savage cutting and pulling and so on. And he used to come in, Harry Sharp used to come in after a day like that, after Gatting had decimated the bowlers, and just say, brutal, bloody brutal. And it was just unceremoniously destructive, almost sadistic in its destructiveness.
Yeah, and it was the cleanness of the hitting, I think. The sound off the bat, it was just every time he hit it, you knew it was four or six. You didn't think, oh, is he half got that or whatever. That, you know, sometimes in one day cricket, T20 cricket, you know, someone will muscle one over the boundary and you think he hasn't quite got that. He slightly clothed it, but I don't know, big bats, shorter boundaries, whatever, strong players, huge backswing. But there was none of that. I mean, very little of that at all. There was one thick edge through the slip cordon, and that was about it. Everything else seemed to come right out the middle of the bat, and I think it was the clean striking that was the feature of Johnny Bairstow's play. I mean, he's played some fine innings. He's played a couple of decent innings recently in Test matches. He played one in Sydney for not so long ago, in the Ashes series. He played one in the West Indies as well. But the cleanness of this striking, and I think Michael Vaughan made the point afterwards. England are a very strong 50 over team. They only needed 50 overs to knock off the runs, 299. So it was interesting listening to Bairstow afterwards as well, because he said, well, it was 160 off 38 overs at tea. That's no trouble these days. I mean, it was so nonchalant. I mean, it used to be 160 after tea on the last day of a Test match, no chance. You got no chance of winning a game from there. Tom Latham, he said at tea, yeah, we thought we had a good chance of winning. Four down if we could get another wicket. And that was the key, really, for New Zealand. They just couldn't break that fifth wicket stand, not in time anyway. By the time Bairstow was out, the game was over. I think that was the fascinating thing. It was England were walking that knife edge. I know they had folks to come, but they got a bit of a tail. And if either of those two had got out, it would have been quite difficult, I think, for England to win that match. But once Bairstow did get out, folks could come in and just put the cherry on top of the very delicious cake. I mean, more boundaries in this match, Yoz, than any other Test match in history. Astonishing.
It is, and it's a measure of a few things. Certainly the power of modern batsmanship, the ambition and adventure of modern batsmanship as well. The fast outfield, slightly short boundaries. The boundary sort of cuts in at the corner near the pavilion with the new stand. Mm. So it's a really short boundary there. Remarkable. You get 553 in the first innings. You snooze, you lose.
Yeah.
Wow. Interesting that Bairstow and pulling. I mean, I thought his pull shots off his nose end today were so destructive and brilliant. Bat speed was absolutely incredible. And I remember when he first came into Test cricket, he struggled a bit with the short ball. I think I remember Kemar Roach from West Indies giving him some trouble at Trent Bridge, of all places. Yeah. And then I remember being down at the practice session a few years later when Bairstow was recalled to the team, and he was still struggling a bit with his pull shot. And I think it was Paul Collingwood had one of those sort of ramps that you flick the ball off for slip catching, and he put it in the net, and he was hurling rubber balls, sort of incredibles, off this ramp, making them rise up at Bairstow from short range to get him practicing his pull shot. And I just stood there for about 10 minutes in total awe at the speed. Bairstow was like being in a coconut shy. This ball was being hurled by Collingwood, flying off the ramp towards his head, and he was flailing around with the bat and whacking these balls into all parts. And in some of the shots were a bit top edgy, but I thought then there's a guy who's tried to address an issue and really gone for it in a very intense way. And so now, you bowl short to him, the bat comes flying through. He's so powerful anyway, isn't he? And even a top edge goes for six.
Yeah, well, you can't play the short ball in Test cricket. You're not going to have a successful Test career, are you? I mean, let's face it, you have to be able to play the short ball. So if you have got a weakness against it, you have to go away and work at it. And yeah, the ball was just disappearing today into the stands. He hit seven sixes, and New Zealand came out after tea, and they tried that sort of leg theory. Matt Henry banging it in, and the thing is, it's quite a short, as you say, it's quite a short boundary to the new stand, and they were just disappearing straight out the middle of the bat. And New Zealand looked a well-beaten side a long way before the end. Now, here's something, Yoz, feature of this match, and in features of previous games as well, which we might want to talk about, is that New Zealand were a bowler down today. They had an injury, and Carl Jameson couldn't bowl in the second innings. He was slightly hampered with the bat as well. He had to come in at number 10, and he didn't bowl in the last part of England's first innings.
Hang on a minute. Hampered with the bat. I have to question that before. I know what you're going to say, but first, I just want to question the hampered with the bat bit, because Carl Jameson didn't appear to be hampered with the bat. They bowled bouncers to him, and he was throwing the bat as if it was the last thing on earth that he had to do, was to hit the ball out of the park. Why was he doing that? 60 not out, Mitchell at the other end. Why didn't he play for him? Especially if he had a bad back. Why didn't he just, you know, sway out of the way, duck out of the way, fend it off, play a few singles and get the strike to the other man instead of swishing and swashing and getting out very quickly? So I don't quite buy that he was restricted with the bat, but carry on.
Well, the reason he might have been not ducking and swaying is because he had a bad back, because he didn't have that plax that
flex. Well, he ducked one. Well, he ducked one ball.
Well, everything was short at him, wasn't it? So, you know, you got in the end. And, I mean, he is quite an aggressive player. And we'll come to New Zealand's batting in just a moment, because I thought it was pretty poor. But, yeah, so what about substitutes in Test cricket? Mm. Every other sport, every other sort of top level sport, most other sport, you know, have substitutes, doesn't it? And cricket, it's funny how cricket is sort of held on, no substitutes for injuries. But it does now have substitutes for concussion, doesn't it? And it has substitutes for COVID, but not for injury. I don't know what the protocols, you know, could be. I mean, it is open to cynicism, isn't it?
Abuse.
It is potentially open to abuse. Cricket's always been, about keeping 11 players on the field and keeping them fit throughout the game. You know, I can think of the first Ashes test in 2019, where, Jimmy Anderson went in the fetlock after about half an hour of the first day. So England had to play with 10 men, really, didn't they? You had to play with 10 against Australia's 11 for the whole of the game for almost 5 days. You could say, well, it's about fitness. But every other sport had substitution. I mean, there was a time when football didn't have substitutions. Rugby the same. But the games have moved on. I mean, I was thinking on the way back this evening, could you have a situation where, if a player was out of the game through injury, you have some sort of time period before someone else can come in. So you don't have straight away, can't just one guy walk off, another guy walk on nice and fresh. You might have, I don't know, a session or something like that before you can bring another player on if you're in the field, say. It's just something I was thinking about. Because they do, it is an intense game. They do play a lot. And, fast bowlers, there are a lot of injuries among quick bowlers. Anyway, it's just a thought. What about substitutions in cricket? Am I talking out my hat? Is it nonsense? Or is it a possibility?
No, I think it's a perfectly reasonable point. And the stakes are very high now. And the battles are intense. So it is a reasonable point. In a way, it can massively sway the balance of a match. I mean, the thing is, Test cricket is supposed to be, I heard someone saying this the other day, Test cricket is an endurance test. And it is. That's exactly why it's 5 days of cricket. And that's why it's called a Test match as well. So I'm not totally bought into the idea of substitutions, because, you could just go a little bit lame. And sometimes it's psychosomatic, actually, isn't it, as well? You're a bowler, you're not really doing that well. You're feeling a bit of a liability, start feeling a bit achy and I need to go off, captain, I'm injured. And that's convenient, because you can bring somebody fresh on. So I'm not entirely convinced. I think there has to be some kind of criteria. And if someone is clearly quite badly injured, as in Anderson has to limp off in the fourth over on the first day, then there's a reasonable case. I think if it looks like it's a convenient injury because you want to play somebody else who's fresher, then you've got to look out for that. But it's certainly worth more discussion.
Yeah, I mean, that's why I said there might be a delay. You can't just bring a guy on straight away or a woman on straight away. There might have to be a session delay before you can swap one in, swap one out, to get away from that sort of like slightly cynical injury that you think, it's an injury of convenience. I mean, it happened to New Zealand in the last Test match as well, didn't it? I mean, Colin de Grandhomme had to go off and, he's out of the series. Clearly it was a serious injury, or certainly a serious enough injury to keep him out of the next game, out of the series. Then that hampered New Zealand as well. They have suffered in this series. Even if Jameson had played, England might still have won. The ball was disappearing, but there was a much greater burden on the main three. Tim South had a really poor game, didn't he? He struggled with the ball a lot. Took a good slip catch today, but I mean his match figures. I mean, draw the curtains across them really. Tim, over 200, one for over 200 from 43 overs. I mean, it was Pongo. He was
started awfully today as well, didn't it? Bowling to to Alex Lee's 3 fours in the first over. Two lovely juicy R volleys whacked to the cover boundary. And actually it was Lee's who got England going, really, didn't he? I think he's obviously been told, play shots. You know, it's not about survival. It's about being positive and looking to get the scoreboard going while you're out there, and, you know, without being reckless. And it's certainly worked in this test for him.
Yeah, it did help England at the start. I think it sort of lifted the crowd as well. Although that was, you know, soon a bit of deflation when Zach Crawley was out, caught by Southie at slip for naught. He has one of those outside edges, doesn't he, Zach Crawley? And the ball just seems to find it very regularly. I don't know what England do about him at the top of the order. I mean, if you win in a way, you can carry players for a bit longer. And yeah, there is a general trend these days to keep a player on the side for a bit longer. That's an issue. England in general, it's been two fantastic test matches, two fantastic victories from England, based on the quality of Root and the brilliance of Bairstow and Stokes today and Pope. You know, so Pope was a big step forward, but you know, they still have one or two issues at the top. Crawley, obviously, one of them. They'd love to see him get a score. The spinner is another issue. There's a long-term solution to that. There's not a short-term solution. And, you know, I suppose, you know, eventually, sooner rather than later, they are going to have to replace and do something about Jimmy and Stuart Broad, aren't they? I mean, that's obvious, and they've got a lot of bowlers injured. So enjoy it, because it's been a fantastic couple of test matches. But there are still issues, and they're not a perfect team, not by any means. But actually, you know, you can, having that sort of that positive approach has, I think, just lifted everyone, hasn't it? The backroom change has made a difference. But you know, can you sustain it over a consistent period? That's going to be the challenge for England. And also, they're playing against the New Zealand side, who are probably on a bit of a dip after winning the World Test Championship last year. You know, a few retirements, and you know, they have injuries to key bowlers in the last two Test matches, which has definitely undermined their cause. But you know, they were in it at tee. It was a game that it was hard to call at tee. You know, whether it was England's draw or New Zealand's, but that amazing half an hour, 40 minutes of cricket, it was just absolutely stunning. Some of the most stunning Test cricket I think I've seen. Well, you know, 2019 at Headingley, but and also go back to Cape Town, that incredible partnership between Stokes and Bairstow in Cape Town when they put on 399. Now, this one was a 179 in 20 overs. Just amazing if you were there.
For nearly four decades, JMK Security Solutions has provided protection for homes and businesses. I know firsthand. I'm Jeff Beckman, and with my wife, Kim, we started JMK Security Solutions. Our attention to detail, service after the sale, and product knowledge are the foundation of our success. JMK Security has routinely been recognized as the best of Madison for security companies. We expect that trend to continue as the next generation, our son Jeffrey, takes over as president. Let us protect what is valuable to you. JKSecurity.com.
Since J&K Security Solutions opened in 1987, our attention to detail and customer service have been our strongest assets. I'm President Jeffrey Beckman. We'll always do our best to find the most efficient and cost-effective solution to every job we tackle. Whether it's security for your home or business, installing video surveillance, or being able to control your garage doors from your phone, we can help you feel empowered with simple and user-friendly technology. Let's work together to secure your home or business. JKSecurity.com.
Another great day for the statisticians today, and Johnny Bairstow nearly broke the English Test record for the quickest century of all time in a Test match. That record, of course, is held by Gilbert Jessop, who made 100 in 77 minutes, actually, in an Ashes Test match in 1902. I'm just looking back into one of my books, actually, the History of the Ashes, and just looking at a little bit of an account of Gilbert Jessop, who, of course, came from your favourite county, Gloucestershire. And it says when he came into bat, enter Jessop, the croucher, as he was known, for his wide, hunched stance. A big-hitting Botham Eskall rounder who loved eating beef, he was described in Gloucestershire circles as a human catapult, who wrecks the roofs of distant towns when set in his assault. He was completely fearless, as evidenced by the fact that he never wore a box when he batted.
Oh.
He once clubbed Yorkshire for, imagine that. He once clubbed Yorkshire for 100 in 45 minutes. He was basically a 2020 specialist, you know, a century before 2020 was born. And he made this 100 against the Australians in 77 minutes, which in terms of time is the fastest 100 in Ashes history. And clearly, Zoltz or some other statisticians have figured out that it was a 76-ball 100.
Yeah, so that's right.
Bairstow missed it by one.
Yeah, that's right. I'm looking at the stats now. Yeah, he's in there at 76 balls. The fastest 100 out of interest was by Brendan McCullum. Remember him? Have you heard of him, Brendan McCullum?
Mm.
54 balls.
Who's that?
Yeah, 54 balls. Viv Richards second on 56. And then you go down the list and we get to Jessop, 76 balls. I'm just looking at the scorecard from that match. He actually hit 17 fours and no sixes in that match at the Oval against Australia. But he did come in at 48 for 5 and he was dismissed at 187 for 7. So he made 104 in the time he was at the crease. And it was a remarkable victory for England. I mean, England still went on. They went on to win the game, despite the fact that they were really struggling. And then there was the famous, you know, Rhodes and Hurst, we'll get them in singles. And there was that partnership for the 10th wicket that took England over the line to help them win that test match. But no sixes.
There's a reason for that. And that is because sixes weren't sort of really invented. Well, there wasn't a boundary rope that you had to clear until 1912. Before that, a six was only recorded if you hit it out of the ground. If you hit it into the stand, it only counted as four. And it was only in 1912 they introduced, you know, a boundary rope or a boundary line. And once you hit it over that, it was recorded as six. What do they need now, do you think? they need a 12 or something. I mean, some of his sixes that he hit in this game, sort of in the second tier, and Bairstow as well. They're certainly worth eight, I reckon.
Well, I remember Adam Holyoake, when he was captain of Surrey, when he played for England, he said that if you hit the ball out of the ground, you should get 12 runs. And, you know, that would encourage players to go for the big shot. Well, they don't need a great deal of encouragement. We talked about having substitutes in cricket. Perhaps they all, you know, we're always sort of tinkering, I suppose, with the laws of the game. Perhaps if you do hit the ball out of the ground, you could get 10 or 12. Some grounds, obviously, a bit smaller than others. I'm pretty sure that from my seat that Will Jacks hit David Payne of Gloucestershire out of the ground at the Oval in a T20 match a couple of weeks ago. I was watching at deep third, right back in the stand, and it went over fine leg, and I think he hit it into the road, into Kennington Oval Road, outside the ground at the Oval, over deep back with square leg. I'm pretty sure he did, which, you know, it was a sizable hit because they were playing right in the middle of the square at the Oval. Massive blow. So, yeah, I think that should be worth 12, yeah, unless they're playing against Gloucestershire, of course.
There's Liam Livingstone's hit a couple of 12s in the last year or so, hasn't he? And I tell you who else has. Tim David, playing in the 100, hit an absolute monster at Lords. I think it was in the final of the 100, actually, which went over the mound stand, pretty much matched by Paul Sterling, who also hit one in the same direction, a sort of pick-up off your legs with extra vroom. And they just sailed onto the roof of the mound stand, and I think one of them did actually end up in the Wellington Road. So there are some monster hits. No one, of course, since Albert Trott in, I think it was 1899, has hit one over the Lord's Pavilion. I've seen a couple close. In fact, I've been hit into the second tier of the Lord's Pavilion by Johnny's dad, David Bairstow, who launched my slower ball into the members on the second tier one time, but no one's actually ever hit it over the pavilion apart from Albert Trott in 1899. Anyway, there is some big hitting, and who'd want to be a bowler? And it's uncanny. You mentioned Brendan McCullum there. It's uncanny the resemblance that this New England seems to be making of the New Zealand side that came here in 2015, captained by McCullum and very much piloted by him. now, you know, his influence is sort of on the balcony or in the dressing room rather than on the field, but it can still be really felt.
Yeah, it's worth just talking about New Zealand themselves, actually, New Zealand's batting in their second innings. As you look at their scorecard, they were bowled out for 284. I thought they could have, you're right, I mean, we did touch on this earlier, they could have played it a bit cannier this morning. You had Henry and Jameson and Bolt all out hitting, both Henry and Jameson to short balls, and then Bolt sort of whacking Anderson to mid off. And actually at the other end there was Mitchell, 62 not out. I mean, this bloke, poor bloke, he made 252 runs in the match once out, and he ends up on the losing side. I mean, that is a remarkable stat in itself. England never looked like getting him out. Perhaps they thought they had enough runs, the way Bolt played, say that last big stroke. You know, they thought they had 300 in the bank. Perhaps they thought, you know, that was enough. That sort of score was a decent sized score, but on this surface, on this surface with this outfield, it was worth, you know, less on another ground, if you know what I mean.
I think also it depends what happens in a way. Bowlers don't bowl as well if they're being put under the pump like the England batsmen were this afternoon. You don't exploit the help in the pitch nearly as effectively. You're almost kind of slightly intimidated by the way you're running in. You're all exasperated and in the end pretty forlorn. And it's these small margins, isn't it? If New Zealand had got, say, another wicket at 93 for 5 or 100 for 5, you can see the a renewed vigour and rejuvenation of the New Zealand attack. And suddenly someone like Southee comes on, having been, you know, pumped around for quite a few boundaries earlier on, with, you know, a fresh optimism, finds a bit of help. The old ball did do things, and you find that happens more if the bowlers are confident and the batsmen are tentative. Yeah. And it was the reverse.
Yeah, they just couldn't hold England. But I thought New Zealand frittered away wickets in their innings. I mean, you can make a good argument out for the fact that that England didn't bowl New Zealand out. New Zealand sort of effectively bowled themselves out in their innings. I mean, all 10 wickets were tossed away, I think. And I think that's fair. I mean, two of them are run outs, which, you know, was pretty poor. And if you just put a highlights reel together, just cut them all together, bang, 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 you say, hold on a second, what was going on here? You know, there were no wickets sort of pitched up, nicked to slip, pitched up, nicked to the keeper, anything like that. It was, you know, it was big shots being played, caught in the ring, run outs, short balls wafting at them. And so New Zealand might want to look at that. I don't know whether that was the McCullum influence, you know, that they wanted to play in an aggressive way as well, you know, a New Zealand way. But it didn't work for them. And they 284 all out. It was a decent enough second innings total, 300 to win, 72 overs. But England showed them how to do it. Their hitting was much, well, obviously it was. It was just much cleaner and more deadly, more ruthless. It was an absolutely ruthless batting display from Bairstow and Stokes. But, you know, at 93 for 4, the game looked almost over. I remember just watching, actually, Stokes walk down the steps, and I thought, this is the game now. England can still win if this man, you know, does well. And, you know, there we go. But if they get him out, then it changes. Right, you know, same as Lords, really, wasn't it? If De Grandem hadn't overstepped, England would have been five down there and struggling. But, there, you know, there weren't those sort of chances this afternoon. It was such clean hitting from both Stokes and Bairstow. What did you make of Stokes saying at the end? I think it must have been just the adrenaline going through him at the end, where he said, you know, the Ashes 2019 World Cup final, this was better. I don't know how you quantify it.
No,
but
it's always the most recent success which seems the most the most exciting in your mind. But I think if you put them all together, I think that Stokes 100 at Headingley in the Test match, well, I actually added up some sort of imaginary points for that innings, for the quality of the attack, for the situation, for having to farm the strike with the number 11, for the length of the innings, for the fact the pitch was helping the bowlers quite a bit, for the situation as well in the game itself, and the situation in the series as well. Factoring all that in, I made that marginally better than Graham Gooch's 100 at Headingley in 1991, when he dominated the second innings against West Indies and won a Test match for England there, and against a phenomenal West Indies attack. I made Stokes' innings in 2019 at Headingley the best there's ever been by an English batsman in kind of modern times. Peterson's innings of 186 in Mumbai would be up there very close as well. World Cup, well, that was just an extraordinary sequence of events in a way. Rather than Stokes' own innings, it was the bolt stepping on the rope. It was the ricochet off the bat. It was all sorts of other silly circumstances. Obviously, it was the super over as well, and England winning on boundaries at the end. So many bizarre incidents makes that, I think, the greatest game. But the greatest innings is that Stokes at Headingley. This one from Bairstow, yeah, it's got to be up there. It's got to be in the top five alongside Peterson's 186 in Mumbai for sure. Perhaps not quite as heroic and mercurial as the innings of Stokes at Headingley in 2019. How do you see it? Yeah. I mean, you were commentating then, and of course, in a way, it was almost today a repeat of your great commentary line at the start of this podcast, because it was Stokes hitting the winning boundary through square cover.
Do you know, it's funny, I thought of that actually when he did it, because it was a very similar shot and a very similar reaction at the end. He sort of held one arm up in the air, he smashed it through the offside and then stood there and just held one arm off up. It was quite similar actually to the winning runs at Headingley. I mean, I commentated on Peterson's unbelievable innings in Mumbai. I suppose the thing was about the Mumbai one is it didn't have there were England supporters there, but it didn't have the same sort of atmosphere at the ground because he was flaying the Indian bowlers all around the ground. But I mean, Alistair Cook I was talking about it to him on air and off air, and we were talking about that innings, and we talked about degree of difficulty, and he said that they were netting on the day before the game, and they were about four away, so it was a similar sort of surface. He said, it was really hard. The pitch, the ball was ragging. It was really tough. And then Peterson went out and played an unbelievable innings in the same Test match, for example. Monty bowled an absolutely stunning delivery to get rid of Tendulkar that was sort of drifted in, like leg stump, and hit the top of his off stump. It was that hard to score. And although Alistair got 100 as well, a bit more workmanlike, still a fine innings on that surface. So I think that Peterson's innings was one of the great innings to come up with that in India on those sorts of pitches. Against the spinners that India had, I think it's about degree of difficulty, wasn't it? And there was a different sort of degree of difficulty today, but the batting conditions were extremely favourable to Bairstow. But he still produced something absolutely stunning. And I think that you're right. The Stokes innings at Headingley, it was the moment, wasn't it? It was the pressure, it was the situations, all the other factors. It was the slow start and then the change of gears and the smacking it into the stands. To hit the reverse sweep into the West Stand against Nathan Lyon. I suppose the one thing I think about the Stokes innings at Headingley, and it still sort of nags away at me a bit, is the fact that if Australia had reviewed that one or had a review left, they'd have won the game. Do you know what I mean? They made that stupid mistake a few minutes before when they reviewed one that wasn't out, and if they still had that review left, they would have won the match. And actually, of course, there were only two reviews then, weren't there? But now there are three because we've got one home umpire and one away umpire. If they'd had three reviews, they would have won the game as well. So, that doesn't take anything away from Stokes' innings at Headingley. It was still a magnificent innings, but England probably, they wouldn't have won the game because they'd have reviewed it and Ben Stokes would have been given out. It's hard to quantify, isn't it? You're right. It is fun. Recency, you're right. Recency tends to sort of dominate people's thinking, doesn't it? But I think he was talking about the feeling. I think they're talking about the feeling afterwards. I suppose it's because he was captain.
Well, he's captain, isn't he? I was going to say, and he must think that captaining Test cricket is a breeze. Matthew Potts must think Test cricket's pretty easy as well. Although he hasn't taken many wickets in this Test match, he's played 2-1-2, so he must be loving it as well. Now, what's the upshot of this? Obviously, England have won the series with one to play, beating the world champions, and I think lifted themselves off the bottom of the World Test Championship table. Is that right?
Hurrah! England are no longer bottom of the World Test Championship table. They are up to eighth. Bangladesh are ninth, and New Zealand are seventh. England's percentage is still pretty low, 25% points ratio. Australia, 75%. England played 15 matches. Australia played 8. It's all based on percentages. South Africa second at the moment. India third. Can England qualify? It's difficult to do the arithmetic, really. If they won all their matches, they might better push up the table. Could they drag South Africa down? Could they drag India down? Could they sneak in? difficult to tell with a percentage situation, but you just keep on winning. But Bangladesh bottom now. England no longer bottom of the World Test Championship table. I would think probably the favourites of the final, Australia, India, and next year at Lord's. But you know, plenty of cricket to be played before then. It's been a long day, Yoz. It's been a long day and a long test match.
You better get your sleep in. Yeah, I know. It has. Hardly any interruptions and any, well, a little bit, one day was lost about 40 minutes play. But for those great supporters of five-day cricket, another very strong argument, five-day test cricket, very strong argument given today at Trent Bridge. England now changed tempo briefly for 3 one-day internationals in the Netherlands with Owen Morgan's team. And just as a little, I don't know, aperitif for that little tournament, I actually watched Owen batting the other day for Middlesex in the Vitality Blast against Surrey, that needle across the river derby between the two, which Surrey actually comfortably won. And Jason Roy, he batted well. He scored about 85 off hardly any deliveries, looked very good. I'll tell you who looked very good. Jamie Overton. Look out for Jamie Overton in one-day cricket with the bat. He hit some stonking shots towards the end of the Surrey innings and then bowled a fiery spell with the ball as well. Of course, he bounced out his brother, Craig, the other day, and poor Craig suffered concussion. So that's a sort of weird situation for the family to be in. But Morgan came into bat at number three, actually, for Middlesex. He's had a few injury issues. And I thought he looked a little bit out of sorts. And I know that we've said that about Morgan a number of times before. But he's struggling a bit for runs at the moment. And he was late on the ball. He was facing Chris Jordan, who was bowling pretty well, pretty lively. But I just thought Morgan looks as if he's struggling a bit. And he didn't get the bat on the ball much. He only scored a couple of runs and then tried to pull Jamie Overton and was late on it and skied one to deep square leg. And toddled off. I don't know. I mean, I hope he recovers his form. I'm his biggest fan, but I don't know. He hasn't made a T20 50 for some time. Maybe the Netherlands will be a slightly easier ride and can help him just ease his way back in. And I hope so. But watch this space, I suppose.
Well, there are plenty of, you know, who are knocking on the door. So many good white ball cricketers that England have. Of course, Owen Morgan has the benefit of being the captain, sort of the overlord, really, the sort of the master strategist. But can you just have a sort of Mike Brearley-esque type figure in a one-day team these days? You've got to be worth your place, haven't you, as a batter as well? So, yeah, there's the challenge for him to regain his form and dominance with the bat. I think that's it, Yoz. It's been a long test match. It's been a brilliant game. It's been a long day, what a day. Fantastic. It's time to have a bit of a... Well, the England's white ball matches start on Friday, but I'm going to have a bit of a break from the test match scene and look forward to the next game at Headingley on Thursday week, where England look to win the series 3-0 if they possibly can and try to rise even more up that World Test Championship table.
Yeah, absolutely. And well done to England's nutritionists for getting England through this 5 days with such a triumphant finish. As I said at the start, the Barest of Margins podcast is available now to listen to see what England do really eat during a 5 day test match. And I think we should finish, Simon, with your commentary from Headingley 2019, but transposed into Trent Bridge 2022. Thanks for listening, everyone.
Stokes flashes it away through the covers for four, and England have won the match.
Sports Social Podcast Network.